Duncan bridled at the sarcasm. "Can't you see it yourself, sir?" "Stable rat Seleucid bulls are bred to be vicious. The Duke knows what he's doing." Eres crossed his scarecrow arms over his chest, but he didn't move closer to the cage. "Besides, the more keyed up this one is, the better he'll fight. And our Duke certainly likes to give a good performance. His people love it." As if to emphasize Eresk's point, the bull battered itself against the force field, bellowing a deep roar from the vast engine of its chest. Its horned head and leathery hide were gashed in places where it had injured itself, trying to trample anything in sight. "I think we should pick a different bull, Master Eresk."
"Nonsense," the other replied, growing more impatient now.
"The Atreides' own stable veterinarian has performed body tissue tests, and everything checked out. You should be ready for the paseo, not in here causing trouble. Run along now, before you miss your chance."
"I'm trying to prevent trouble, sir," Duncan insisted.
He looked defiantly at Eresk. "I'm going to go talk to the Duke myself. Maybe he'll listen."
"You'll do no such thing, stable rat."
Moving like an eel, Eresk grabbed him by the slippery fabric of the costume.
"I've been patient enough with you for the Duke's sake, but I can't let you ruin his bullfight. Don't you see all the people out there?"
Duncan struggled and cried for help. But the others had already lined up at the gates for the grand parade around the arena. The fanfare sounded a deafening note, and the crowd cheered in anticipation. Without being unduly rough, Eresk tossed him into one of the empty stalls, turning on the containment field to keep him in it. Duncan stumbled onto piles of trampled feed smeared with green-brown manure.
"You can sit out the event here," Eresk said, looking sad. "I should have known to expect trouble from you, a Harkonnen sympathizer."
"But I hate the Harkonnens." Duncan stood up, trembling with rage. His silk clothes were ruined. He hurled himself against the bars just as the bull had done, but he had no chance of escaping. Brushing himself off to look presentable again, Eresk strode toward the arched openings for the paseo. The stable master flashed a glance over his shoulder.
"The only reason you're here, stable rat, is because the Duke likes you. But I've run his stables for nigh on 20 years, and I know exactly what I'm doing. You just leave it be. I've got work to do."
In the cage beside Duncan, the Seleucid bull simmered like a boiler about to explode. Duke Paulus Atreides stood in the center of the arena. He turned slowly, drawing energy from the enthusiasm of the crowd. Residual heat rose from the packed stands. He flashed them all a sparkling, confident grin. They roared with approval. Oh, how his people love to be entertained. Paulus switched on his body shield at partial setting. He would have to maneuver carefully for his protection. The element of danger kept him on his toes, and it made for greater suspense among the spectators. He held the muleta, a brightly colored cloth on a pole, which he would use to distract the attacking animal and divert its attention from his body core. The long barbed staffs, poison-dipped banderillas, were wrapped close to the pole for Paulus to use when he needed them. He would get near to the creature and spike them into its neck muscles, injecting a neuro-poison that would gradually weaken the Seleucid bull so that he could deliver the coup de grace. Paulus had been through these performances dozens of times before, often for major Caladan holidays. He was at the top of his form in front of crowds, and enjoyed showing off his bravery and skills. It was his way of repaying his subjects for their devotion. Each time, it seemed, his physical abilities rose to their peak as he rode the narrow edge in the contest between living his own life to the hilt and risking it as he fought a raging beast. He hoped Romber and Kylea would enjoy the show and feel more at home. Only once, back when he was younger, had Paulus actually felt threatened. A sluggish, plodding bull had lured him into switching off his shield during a practice session, and then had turned into a whirlwind of horns and hooves.
These mutated creatures were not just violent, but two-brain smart as well. And Paulus had made the mistake of forgetting that. But only once. The bull had slashed him with its horns, laying his side open. Paulus had fallen onto the sand, and would have been gored to death, had he not been practicing at the same time as a much younger Thufir Hawat. Seeing the danger, the warrior Mentat had instantly dropped all pretense of protocol in the bull ring, and leaped forth single-handedly to attack and dispatch the creature. During the ensuing fight, the ferocious bull had ripped a long wound in Hawat's leg, leaving him with a permanent curling scar. The scar had become a reminder to all of the Mentat's intense devotion to his duke. Now, under the cloudy skies, and surrounded by his subjects, Duke Paulus waved and took a long, deep breath. Fanfare signaled that the fight was to begin. House Atreides was not the most powerful family in the Landsraad, nor the wealthiest. Still, Caladan provided many resources. The Pundi rice fields, the bountiful fish in the seas, the kelp harvest, all the fruit and produce from the arable land, and handmade musical instruments and bone carvings done by the aboriginal people in the south. In recent years, there had been an increased demand for tapestries woven by the sisters in isolation, a religious group sequestered in the terraced hills of the eastern continent. In all, Caladan provided everything its people could possibly want, and Duke Paulus knew his family's fortunes were secure. He was immensely pleased that one day he could pass it all on to his son Leto. The mutated Seleucid bull charged.
Oh-ho!
The Duke laughed and flailed his multi-hued muleta, skittering backward as the bull thundered past. Its head tossed from side to side, thrashing with its spiny shovel of a skull. One of the horns moved slowly enough to ripple through the pulsing Holtzman's shield, and the Duke slid sideways, just enough so that the bone spike barely scratched his outer armor. Seeing how close the horn had come to their beloved leader, the audience let out a collective gasp. The Duke sidestepped the bull as it charged past, kicking up powdered sand. The beast skidded to a stop. Paulus held his muleta with one hand, jiggling the cloth, and snatched out one of his barbed banderillas. He glanced up at the ducal box, touching the hooked tip of the banderilla to his forehead in a salute. Leto and Prince Romber had leaped to their feet in excitement, but Helena remained frozen in her chair, her expression clouded, hands clasped in her lap. The bull wheeled about and reoriented itself. Normally, Seleucid bulls became dizzy after missing their target, but this one did not slow a bit. Duke Paulus realized that his monstrous opponent had a greater energy than he had ever seen, keener eyesight, hotter fury. Still, he smiled. Defeating this worthy opponent would be his finest hour, and a fitting tribute to the exiled Ixians in his care. The Duke played with the bull for a few more passes, dancing beyond the reach of its horns, completing his expected performance for the excited spectators. Around him, the partial shield shimmered. Seeing that the bull did not tire after the better part of an hour, though, and that it remained focused on killing him, Duke Paulus grew concerned enough that he made up his mind to end the contest as swiftly as possible. He would use his shield, a trick he had learned from one of the finest matadors in the Imperium. The next time the creature shot past, hooves hammering the packed sand, its horns ricocheted off the Duke's personal shield, a collision that finally disoriented the beast. The Duke grasped the banderilla and plunged it into the bull's back like a stake, setting the barbed hook into cable-thick neck muscles. Oily blood spilled out from the slash and its hide. Paulus released the handle of the poisoned spear as he twirled out of the way. The drug on the barbed tip should begin to act immediately, burning out the neurotransmitters in the beast's double brain. The crowd cheered, and the bull roared with pain. It spun about and stumbled as its legs seemed to give way. The Duke thought this was caused by the poison,
But, to his surprise, the Seleucid bull floundered to its feet once more and rocketed toward him. Paulus again sidestepped, but the bull managed to snag the muleta on its multiple horns, thrashing its head and tearing the bright ceremonial cloth to shreds. The Duke narrowed his eyes and released his hold. This was going to be a greater challenge than he had expected. The audience cried out in dismay, and he couldn't stop himself from offering them a brave smile. Yes, the difficult fights are the best, and the people of Caladan will remember this one for a long, long time. Paulus held up his second banderilla, slashing it in the air like a thin fencing sword, and turned to face the heavily muscled oncoming bull. He had no cape to distract the animal now, so it would see his body core as its main target. He had only one short, barbed spear as his weapon, and a partial shield for protection. He saw Atreides' guards, even Thufir Hawat, standing at the ringside, ready to race out and assist him. But the Duke raised his hand, forcing them back. He must do this himself. It simply would not do to have a mob of other fighters rushing to his rescue the moment things got a little sticky. The Seleucid bull pawed the ground, glaring at him with its multifaceted eyes, and the Duke thought he saw a flash of understanding there. This creature knew exactly who he was, and it intended to kill him. But the Duke had similar thoughts in his own mind. The bull charged directly toward him and picked up speed. Paulus wondered why the neurotoxin hadn't yet slowed it down. Deadly questions occurred to him. How can this be? I dipped the banderillas in poison myself. But was it really poison? Wondering if there had been sabotage, the Duke held out the banderilla, its sharp barb glinting in the cloudy sunlight. The bull approached, steaming, frothing. Foam from its nostrils and mouth flew up to fleck its black, scaly face. As they closed to within meters of each other, the bull fainted to the right. Duke Paulus jabbed with his short spear, but the beast instantly swerved and attacked from a different direction. This time the barb caught on a knob of the bull's horny skin, but did not sink in. The small weapon tore out of the Duke's grasp and dropped to the sand as the bull dashed past. For a moment, Paulus was weaponless. He scrambled backward and snatched for the banderilla on the ground. Turning his back on the bull, he listened for it to grind to a stop, spin around and come back. But as he bent over to retrieve his weapon, the huge bull was suddenly there with impossible speed, horns lowered. The Duke scrambled to one side, trying to get out of the way, but the bull was already within his safety zone, ducking under the partial shield and ramming home. Its long, curved horns gouged deep into the Duke's back, breaking through his ribs and into his lungs and heart. The bull roared with triumph. To the horror of the crowd, it lifted Paulus up, thrashing him from side to side. Blood sprayed on the sand, red droplets slowed by the concave surface of the small shield. The doomed Duke flailed and twitched, impaled on the forest of horns. The audience fell deathly silent. Within seconds, Thufir Hawat and the Atreides guards surged out onto the field, their laser guns cutting the rampaging Seleucid bull into piles of smoking meat. The creature's own momentum caused pieces of the carcass to fly apart in different directions. The decapitated but otherwise intact head thumped onto the ground. The Duke's body pirouetted in the air and landed on its back in the trampled sand. Up in the ducal box, Romber cried out in disbelief. Kylea sobbed. The Lady Helena let her chin sink against her chest and wept. Leto rose to his feet, all color draining from his skin. His mouth opened and closed, but he could find no words to express his utter shock. He wanted to run down into the arena, but saw from the mangled condition of his father that he would never reach him in time. There would be no gasping and whispering of last words. Duke Paulus Atreides, this magnificent man of his people, was dead. Deafening wails erupted from the spectator stands. Leto could feel the vibration rumbling through the ducal box. He couldn't tear his eyes from his father, lying broken and bloodied on the ground. And he knew it was a nightmare vision that would remain with him for the rest of his life. Thufir Hawat stood next to the fallen old duke, but even a warrior Mentat could do nothing for him now. Oddly, his mother's quiet voice cut through the surrounding din, and Leto heard the words clearly, like ice picks. "Leto, my son," Helena said, "you are Duke Atreides now." Machine Vaccine Principle. Every technological device contains within it the tools of its opposite and of its own destruction. Giancana, Imperial Patent Czar. It didn't take the invaders long to make permanent changes in the prosperous underground cities. Many innocent Ixians died and many disappeared, while Kater waited for someone to find and kill him. During brief sojourns from his shielded hiding room, Kater learned that Verniae, the former capital city of Ix, had been renamed Helacia by the Tlelaxu. The fanatical usurpers had even changed imperial records to refer to the ninth planet in the Alcarop system as Xuta, rather than Ix. Kater wanted to strangle any Tlelaxu he found, but instead he developed a subtler plan. He dressed like a low-level worker and doctored forms to show that he had once been a minor line supervisor, one step above a suboid, who had watched over a labor crew of 12 men. He'd read enough about hull plate welding and sealing so that he could claim it had been his job. No one would expect much from him. All around him, the Bene Tlelax were gutting his city and rebuilding it into a dark hell. He abhorred the changes, loathed the Tlelaxu gall, and from what he could see, Imperial Sardaukar had actually assisted in this abomination. Kater could do nothing about it at the moment. He had to bide his time. He was alone here. His father exiled to Kytane and afraid to return. His mother murdered. His twin brother taken away by the guild. Only he remained on Ix, like a rat hiding within the walls. But even rats could cause significant damage. Over the months, Kater learned to blend in, to appear to be an insignificant and cowed citizen. He kept his eyes averted, his hands dirty, his clothes and hair unkempt. He could not let it be known that he was the son of the former ambassador to Kytane, that he had faithfully served House Vernius, and still would, if he could find a way to do it. He had walked freely through the Grand Palais, had escorted the Earl's own daughter, acts that, if known, would mean a death sentence for him. Above all, he could not let the rabid anti-technology invaders discover his shielded hiding place or the devices he had hoarded there. His stockpile might just be the last hope for the future of Ix. Throughout the grottos of the city, Kater watched signs being torn down, streets and districts being renamed, and the little gnomes, all men, no women, occupying huge research facilities for their secret, nefarious operations. The streets, walkways, and facilities were guarded by diligent, thinly disguised Imperial Sardaukar, or the invaders' own shape-shifting face dancers. Shortly after their victory was secured, the Tlelaxu masters had showed themselves and encouraged the suboid rebels to vent their anger on carefully selected and approved targets. Standing back, clothed in a simple workman's jumpsuit, Kater had watched the smooth-skinned laborers cluster around the facility that had manufactured the new self-learning fighting mechs. "House Vernius has brought this upon themselves!" screamed a charismatic suboid agitator, almost certainly a face-dancer infiltrator. "They would bring back the thinking machines. Destroy this place." While the helpless Ixian survivors had watched in horror, the suboid smashed the plaza windows and used thermal bombs to ignite the small manufactory. Filled with religious fervor, they howled and threw rocks, A Tleilaxu master on a hastily erected podium had bellowed into comm speakers and amplifiers. "We are your new masters, and we will make certain the manufacturing abilities of Ix are fully in accord with the strictures of the Great Convention." The flames continued to crackle, and some of the subwoids had cheered, but most didn't seem to be listening. "As soon as possible, we must repair this damage and return this world to normal operations. With better conditions for the subwoids, of course." Kater had looked around, watched the building burn, and felt sick inside. "All Ixian technology must henceforth be scrutinized by a strict religious review board to assure its suitability. Any questionable technology will be scrapped. No one will ask you to endanger your souls by working on heretical machines." More cheering, more smashed plas, a few screams. Kater had realized, though, that the cost of this takeover would be enormous for the Tleilaxu, even with Imperial support. Since Ix was one of the major powerhouse economies in the Imperium, the new rulers could not afford to let the production lines remain idle. The Tleilaxu would make a show of destroying some of the questionable products, such as the reactive mechs, but he doubted any of the truly profitable Ixian devices would be discontinued. Despite the promises of the new masters, the subwoids had been put back to work, as they were bred to do, but this time they followed only Tleilaxu designs and orders. Kater realized that before long, the manufactories would begin pouring out merchandise again, and shiploads of Solaris would flow back into the Bene Tleilax coffers to pay them for this costly military adventure. Now, though, the secrecy and security developed by generations of House Vernius would work against them. Ix had always shrouded itself in mystery, so who would notice the difference? Once the paying customers were satisfied with the exports, no one in the Imperium would much care about internal Ixian politics. Anyone on the outside would forget all that had happened here. It would be cleanly swept under the rug. That must be what the Tleilaxu were counting on, Kater thought. The entire world of Ix, he would never refer to it, not even in his mind, as Xuta, was walled off from the Imperium as an enigma, much as the homeworlds of the Bene Tleilax had been for centuries. The new masters restricted travel off-planet and imposed curfews with deadly force. Face dancers rooted out traitors from hiding rooms similar to Kater's, and executed them without fanfare or ceremony. He saw no end of the repression, but he vowed not to give up. This was his own world, and he would fight for it, in any way he could. Kater told no one his name, called little attention to himself, but he listened, absorbed every whispered story or rumor. And he planned. Not knowing whom to trust, he assumed everyone was an informant, either a face dancer or simply a turncoat. Sometimes an informant was easily recognizable by the directness of a line of inquiry. "Where do you work? Where do you live? What are you doing on this street?" But others were not so easy to detect, such as the gnarled old woman with whom he had initiated a conversation. He'd only meant to ask directions to a work site where he had been assigned. She hadn't sought him out at all, except to appear harmless, somewhat like a child with a grenade in its pocket. "Such an interesting choice of words," she'd said, and he didn't even remember his own phrasing. "And your inflection. You are Ixian nobility, perhaps?" She looked meaningfully at some of the ruined stalactite buildings in the ceiling. He had stammered an answer. "No, although I have been a servant all my life, and perhaps I picked up some of their distasteful mannerisms. My apologies." He had bowed and departed quickly, without ever getting directions from her. His response had been awkward and perhaps incriminating. So he'd thrown away the clothes he'd been wearing and hadn't gone down that narrow street again. Afterward, he had paid more attention than ever before to masking his own vocal identity markers. Whenever possible, he avoided talking to strangers at all. It appalled Kater that so many opportunistic Ixians had switched allegiance to the new masters, forgetting House Vernius in less than a year. In the first days of confusion following the takeover, Kater had hoarded scraps of abandoned technology, from which he had constructed the cross-dimensional Rogo transceiver. Soon, though, all but the most primitive technology had been confiscated and made illegal. Kater still snatched what he could, scavenging anything that might prove valuable. He considered the risk well worth taking. His fight here might continue for years, if not decades. He thought back to the childhood he'd shared with Demur, and the crippled inventor Davy Rogo, who had befriended the boys. In his private laboratory, secreted inside an ignored coal vein in the upper crust, old Rogo had taught the youths many interesting principles, had shown them some of his failed prototypes. The inventor had chuckled, his bright eyes sparkling as he goaded the boys into disassembling and reassembling some of his complicated inventions. Kater had learned a great deal under the crippled man's tutelage. Now Kater recalled his navigator brother's lack of interest when he'd told him of the wavy vision he'd seen in the rubble. Perhaps the ghost of Davy Rogo had not come back from the dead to provide instructions. He'd never seen a similar apparition, before or since. But that experience, whether a supernatural message or a hallucination, had permitted Kater to accomplish a very human purpose, remaining in communication with his twin, maintaining the bond of love as Demur became lost in the mysteries of the guild. Trapped in his various hiding places, Kater had to live vicariously, soaring across the universe in his brother's mind whenever they made contact via the transceiver. Over the months, he learned with excitement and pride of Demur's first solo flights through fold space as a trainee pilot in his own guild ship. Then, a few days ago, Demur had been approved for his first commercial assignment, navigating an unmanned colony transport craft that plied the void far beyond the Imperium. If his outstanding work for the guild continued, the navigator trainee, who had been Demur Pilru, would be promoted to transporting goods and personnel between the primary worlds of the House's Major, and perhaps along the coveted Kaitane routes. He would become an actual navigator, possibly even working his way up to steersman. But the communications device exhibited persistent problems. The silicate crystals had to be sliced with a cutter ray and connected in a precise manner. Then they functioned only briefly before disintegrating from the strain. Hairline cracks rendered them useless. Kater had used the device on four occasions to reach his brother, and after each time he'd had to painstakingly cut and refit new crystals. Kater established careful ties to black market groups that furnished him with what he required. The contraband silicate crystals surreptitiously bore laser-scribed approvals by the Religious Review Board. Ever resourceful, the black marketers had their own means of counterfeiting the approval marks, and had scribed them everywhere, thus frustrating the controlling efforts of the occupation forces. Still, he dealt with the furtive salesman as little as possible to reduce his own risk of being caught. But that also limited the number of times he could talk with his brother. Kater stood behind a barricade with other restless, sweaty people, who studiously refused to recognize each other. He looked out across the sprawling grotto floor to the construction yards, where the skeleton of the partially built Highliner sat. Overhead, portions of the projected sky remained dark and damaged, and the Tleilaxu showed no inclination to repair it. Suspensor-borne searchlights and speakers hovered over the crowd as the gathered people waited for an announcement and further instructions. No one wanted to ask, and no one wanted to hear.
This highliner is of an unapproved Vernius design. The floating speakers boomed in a sexless voice that resonated against the rock walls. And does not meet the standards of the religious review board. Your Tleilaxu masters are returning to the previous design, so this craft is to be dismantled immediately.
A soft susurration of dismay crept across the crowd.
Raw materials are to be salvaged and new work crews established. Construction begins again in 5 days.
Kater's mind whirled as maroon-robed organizers marched through the crowds, assigning teams. As the son of an ambassador, he'd had access to information that had not been available to others of his age. He knew the old-style highliners had a significantly smaller cargo capacity and operated less efficiently. But what possible religious objection could the invaders have to increased profits? What did the Tleilaxu have to gain from less efficient space transport? Then he remembered a story that his ambassador father had told back in a time of smug assurance, that old Emperor Elrud had been displeased with the innovation, since it curtailed his tariff revenue. Pieces began to fit into place. House Carino had provided disguised Sardaukar troops to maintain an iron grip on the Ixion population. And Kater realized that reverting to the old highliner design might be how the Tleilaxu intended to repay the Emperor for his military support. Wheels within wheels within wheels. He felt sick inside. If true, it was such a petty reason for so many lives to have been lost, for the glorious traditions of Ix to have been destroyed, for the overthrow of an entire noble family and a planetary way of life. He was angry with everyone involved, even with Earl Vernius, who should have foreseen this and taken steps not to create such powerful enemies. The call to work came across the PA system, and Kater was assigned to join suboid crews as they dismantled the partially finished ship and salvaged its parts in the grotto yard. Struggling to maintain a bland expression on his face as he wielded a construction laser to sever components, he wiped sweat from his dark hair. He wished instead that he could use the laser to attack the Tleilaxu. Other teams hauled the girders and plates away, stacking them for the next assembly project. With ringing and clanging all around him, Kater recalled a better, more ordered time, when he'd stood with Demur and Kylia on the observation deck above. So long ago, it seemed. They had watched a navigator guide the last new highliner out of the grotto. Perhaps it would be the last such ship ever built, unless Kater could help overthrow these destroyers. The magnificent ship gradually fell to pieces, and the echoing sounds and chemical smells were horrific. Did suboids work this way all the time? If so, he could begin to imagine how they might have been dissatisfied enough to consider a rebellion. But Kater could not believe the violence had been entirely at the workers' instigation. Had this all been part of the Emperor's plan? To destroy House Vernius and quash progress? Where and how the Bene Tleilax came into play in the scheme of influences, Kater wasn't certain. Of all races, these were the most hated people in the known galaxy. Surely Elrud could have found any number of great houses to take over the operations on Ix without disrupting the economics of the Imperium. What else could the Padishah Emperor have in mind for these religious fanatics? Why would he dirty his hands with them? In disgust, Kater watched other changes in the grotto, facilities being modified, as he continued the work of dismantling the highliner. The new Tleilaxu overlords were busy little creatures, always hurrying about in a mysterious manner, setting up clandestine operations in the largest structures on Ix, locking formerly open facilities, shuttering windows, erecting stun fences and minefields, keeping their filthy little secrets.
Kater took it as his mission to learn all those secrets by whatever means necessary, however long it might take him. The Tleilaxu must fall. The ultimate question, why does life exist? The answer, for life's sake. Anonymous, thought to be of Zen Sunni origin. Two reverend mothers stood talking on a treeless knoll, one old, one young. Behind clouds the waning sun, Lao Jin, threw the long shadows of their hooded black robes down the slope. Over the centuries an untold number of other reverend mothers had stood on the same spot, under the same sun, discussing grave matters relevant to their times. If the two women wished, they could revisit those past crises through other memory. The Reverend Mother, Anirul Sado Tonkin, made such thought journeys more than most. Each circumstance was just another minor step along the long, long road. Over the past year, she had let her bronze-brown hair grow long, until its locks hung down to her narrow chin. At the base of the knoll, a white crete building was under construction. Like worker bees, female laborers, each one with an entire blueprint in her mind, operated heavy equipment, preparing to lift roof modules into place. To the rare outside observer, Wallach 9, with its Bene Gesserit libraries and schools, seemed always the same. But the sisterhood was ever adapting for survival, ever changing, ever growing. "They're working too slowly. I want them finished already," Anirul said, rubbing her forehead. She had been experiencing chronic headaches of late. As Mohiyam came closer to term, Anirul's responsibilities as Kwisatz mother were tremendous. "Do you realize how few days remain until the baby is due?" "Blame no one but yourself, Anirul. You demanded that this be no ordinary birthing facility," Mother Superior Harishka said sternly. The Kwisatz mother flushed and looked away. "Every sister knows how important it is. Many of them suspect this is not just another child to be lost in the web of our breeding programs. A few have even been talking about the Kwisatz Haderach." Anirul tucked a loose strand of bronze hair behind her ear. "Unavoidable. All the sisters know of our dream, but few suspect how close it is to reality." She shifted her skirts around her and sat down on the soft grass of the knoll. She gestured toward the construction, where the sounds of carpentry rang clear in the air. "Mohiyam is due to deliver in a week, Mother Superior. We don't even have the roof on yet." "They will finish, Anirul. Calm yourself. Everyone is doing her best to follow your orders." Anirul reacted as if slapped, then covered her reaction. "Does Reverend Mother see me as an untempered and impetuous girl?" Perhaps she had been too insistent with her instructions for the facility, and sometimes Mother Superior looked at her with a certain amount of resentment. "Is she jealous that other memory chose me to lead such an ambitious program? Does she resent my knowledge?" "I'm not as young as you're treating me," Anirul said, against the better judgment of the voices. Very few of the Bene Gesserit had the weight of history inside them the way she did. Very few knew all of the machinations, every step of the Kwisatz Haderach program, every failure or success over the millennia, every deviation in the plan, for more than 90 generations. "I have the knowledge to succeed." Mother Superior frowned at her. "Then put more faith in our Mohiyam. She's delivered 9 daughters for the sisterhood already. I trust her to control the exact moment at which she chooses to give birth, even to delay her labor if necessary." A scrap of brittle hair blew out of its prim containment and feathered across the old woman's cheek.
Her role in this is more important than any birthing facility.
Anirul challenged the chastising tone. True. And we must not have another failure like the last. Not even a reverend mother could master all facets of embryonic development. Through her internal processes, she could set her own metabolism, but not the metabolism of the child. Selecting her baby's sex was an adjustment of the mother's chemistry, choosing the precise egg and sperm to unite. But once the zygote started growing in the womb, the offspring was effectively on its own, beginning a process of growing away from the mother.
Anirul said, I can feel that this daughter will be a crux point.
A loud thump sounded below, and Anirul grimaced. One of the roof sections had tumbled into the interior of the building, and the sister workers rushed about to correct the mistake. Mother Superior uttered a profanity. Through Herculean efforts, the birthing facility was completed, on time, while Kwisatz's mother Anirul marched back and forth. Only hours before the scheduled birth, construction workers and robos put on the finishing touches. Medical equipment was brought in and connected. Glow globes, beds, blankets, even a warm blaze in the archaic wood-burning fireplace Mohiam had requested. As Anirul and Harishka inspected the job, still smelling of dust and construction materials, they paused to watch the noisy entrance of a motorized gurney bearing an enormously pregnant Gaius Helen Mohiam. She was alert and sitting up, already experiencing increased contractions. Reverend mothers and white-smocked medical attendants escorted her in, clucking excitedly like hens.
This was too close, Mother Superior, Anirul said. I don't appreciate additional stress points in an already complex task.
Agreed, said Harishka. The sisters will be reprimanded for their lethargy. Though if your designs had been less ambitious... She let the thought hang in the air. Ignoring Mother Superior, Anirul noted the trim and decoration of the room, with its intricate ivory and pearl inlays and ornate wood carvings. Perhaps she should have had them concentrate more on functionality than on extravagance. Harishka crossed her thin arms over her chest. The design of this new facility is similar to what we had before. Was it really necessary?
This is not similar at all, Anirul said.
Her face flushed, and she washed the defensive tone out of her words. The old birthing room simply wasn't functional anymore. Mother Superior gave a condescending smile. She understood the need for an untainted building, with no old memories, no ghosts. Anirul, through our missionaria protectiva, we manipulate the superstitions of backward peoples. But we sisters aren't supposed to be superstitious ourselves. Anirul took the comment with good humor.
I assure you, Mother Superior, such conjecture is preposterous.
The older woman's almond eyes glittered. Other sisters are saying you thought the old birthing room had a curse on it, which caused the first child's deformities and its mysterious death. Anirul drew herself up straight.
This is hardly the proper time to discuss such a thing, Mother Superior.
She scanned the frantic preparations. Mohiam placed on the birthing bed, sisters gathering warm Carthan weave towels, liquids, pads. An incubator chamber blinked with monitors on the wall. First-ranked midwives bustled around, preparing for unforeseen complications.